Hello and welcome to Mindfulness Music and More with me, Charlene Ibala-Lucas. As always, it's an absolute pleasure to be here with you and to bring you the fourth season of this podcast, focusing on mental health and well-being. In this, the third part of the season, we're focusing on Mental Health Awareness Month in May, and I have the pleasure of speaking to only men from all walks of life about their mental health. Our lineup of guests include mindfulness facilitators, musicians, dancers, photographers, psychologists, entrepreneurs, and student leaders, all of whom will inspire, inform, entertain, and motivate you. So do stay with me for the next hour as we talk about mental health and mindfulness, play some music, and meditate together. My guest today was born and educated in England in 1946. He worked as a photographer and writer, and this has taken him to over 40 countries with a driving concern for ecological issues. In 2012, he founded DEEP, a center for diversity, ecology, ethics, and practice. He regards our multiple global crises as fundamentally a spiritual crisis. He's a qualified mindfulness facilitator, while stressing the need for deeper inquiry to heal trauma through integration and creativity. He recently published a book, The Island, A Mirror for the Soul, Journeys Towards the Heart of Dharma, part memoir, part travelogue, part philosophical critique of modernity. He describes himself as creative, disruptive, open-minded. David Beattie, welcome to Mindfulness, Music and More.
Pleasure to be here.
David, tell me about DEEP and what made you set it up.
This occurred around the time, I think it was in 2012. I had, in fact, been working as a photographer by request of two ecologists, Olivier and Stephanie Hammerlink, who'd been doing a seven-year study of the Tana River Delta. And although I'd been in Kenya many years up till then, I had never visited the River Delta, which was an eye-opener. It's a remarkable place and very different from any other place in Kenya. And they asked me to really take a number of photographs of the Pokomo people, because there are two communities there, the Orma, the pastoral community, and the Pokomo, who are the sedentary people. They have rice chambers, and they, in fact, migrated from the Congo, I believe, about 700 years ago. And the study of the river was very important because it was under threat for a number of reasons. And As you've mentioned, I've been for a long time concerned with the ecological crisis in the world, and I had done another river story for the Smithsonian in India on the Narmada River, so I was very keen to be engaged with this. And they mounted an exhibition of the photographs and a lot of scientific data in 2011 at Alliance Française, and then it moved to the National Museum of Kenya in 2012 and stayed up in the Ecology Gallery for 4 months. So I used that opportunity to ask the director of the museum if he would give me the Ford Hall for free. And myself and another colleague, Michael Asher, invited people to a free interactive discussion on deep ecology, which was quite controversial. And we thought maybe five people will turn up. And in fact, we had about 60 people. Most of them were the TED Talk crowd, because TED Talks got going here in the cinema in Westgate, and then it moved to Brabourne. And so a lot of people came, and the discussion got quite heated, I remember. I had also invited Ikal Angalai, who had won the Goldman Award that year for her work on Friends of Lake Turkana, which was under threat from the dams being built up in Ethiopia. She couldn't make it because she got stuck there in Turkana. And instead I asked Wanuri Kayu, who had made this film, Pumzi, about, which was a short film, which had won a lot of international awards. Which a sort of a theme was a third world water war, and set in a community in East Africa where somebody is looking for signs of life and then plants a tree back in the earth. And she came and gave a brilliant talk about why she made that film. So that's where it all started, and I thought we need to push this agenda somehow, but we need to reflect on our own capacity for change, because obviously much of this is connected with consumer culture and so on.
That's very interesting. And does it? How do you keep this work going on now? Because you founded Deep in 2012. 10 years later, what's its place?
Well, a few years after that, I began holding sessions in one of the spas at James Gachuru. There was a man called William who taught yoga there, and some of those people would stay, and I was just teaching mindfulness practice. Very simply, to see what would happen. and that's how I started doing this and realized that it was a bit of a challenge here because these kind of introspective, meditative things were not really established here at all.
When was this?
This was probably around 2015.
Okay, so a few years back, about seven years ago.
I started thinking about what to do, and I thought, well, that's a starting place.
And have you found in the last 7 years since you started, has the acceptance and understanding of mindfulness changed in Kenya?
I think it is beginning to. It's moving slowly, but I think it's accelerating now, what with the establishment of groups like Conscious Kenya and so on. And Kanga, a yoga studio set up in 2019 in Loreto, and they asked me if I would come and teach mindfulness there. And so, unfortunately, the pandemic struck the beginning of 2020, so it kind of shut down and went online, although I did, in fact, last year run two courses there live in the studio.
And that's wonderful because I teach mindfulness, and teaching it online and face-to-face are two very different experiences.
I agree with you there, and I don't like doing it online. I try to encourage people. People sometimes say they want to, could they do it online? I say, we'd rather have you here because I do interpersonal mindfulness too in dyads.
Yes.
And you need to have two people present at least at the bare minimum. So it's very important, yeah.
Briefly, how did you come to mindfulness?
Well, I have trained in the MBSR teacher training program in the UK, but my origins of this go back to 1981 in Sri Lanka, when I was going through my own life crisis, or one of my life crises there. And I was doing a lot of work in India at that time, and I was invited to stay on a small island on a lagoon, which is actually the focus of the book I've just written. That was my first introduction to the source of mindfulness. The contemporary mindfulness comes from the Theravada tradition and from the Buddha's discourse known as the Satipatthana Sutta, which he gives very pragmatic steps towards understanding this cultivation of awareness. And of course, I was just given, it was a very, very simple island. I was given a hut, there was no electricity. It was just nature full of wild birds, snakes, and all kinds of things. And I was just allowed to stay as long as I want. It wasn't a meditation center for foreigners. It was a place for monks to stay when they were just wanting to get away from wherever they usually were and have a period of introspection.
How fascinating. How long were you there for?
Several months I was there. And I wrote a diary, you see. I kept some diaries in some notebooks. And then as time moved on and I eventually ended up in Kenya, that's another long story, a lot of my stuff was put in storage in the UK. And I thought I'd mislaid these and lost them. But sometime around 2006, 7, I really don't remember, I was visiting my son who'd retrieved a lot of my stuff from storage facility. And he said, it's all up in the attic. And I went through it and I found these diaries. So I came back to Kenya with them and I started reading them. And I thought, well, maybe I can do something with this. It's a bit strange. It's like revisiting an earlier self.
That's we're going to talk about that shortly. But let's first go to your song choice. I've got loads of questions around your life crisis and a book. But your first song choice, what is it and why have you chosen it?
it's always struck me, this aria by called the Liebestod, as an incredibly powerful piece of music. And it's one of the central pieces in the story of Tristan and Isolde, which has many, many versions. It's central to, I think, the development of the myth of romantic love in the Western tradition. And I go into this a little bit in my book. What I came across was, through various references, was a book written in about 1940, which tried to trace the origins of this through Western civilization. And he focused on the myth of Tristan and Isolde as the sort of paradigm of the romantic myth of romantic love, which is a central theme in modernity as well and feeds into novels, films, and even into the advertising industry. Essentially, what he's looking at is this kind of love is a very passionate and intense love, and it really, if you look at it from the point of view of modern psychology, it's a kind of compensation for the failure of integration at an earlier developmental phase in our nurturing process. And the lovers are not really so much in love with each other as in love with being in love.
Okay.
And so it has this intensity where the self tries to resolve its problem of feeling separate, of feeling of separation, by complete fusion with the other. This transports them into this transcendent other world, which seems more real than the everyday contingent world. And the danger, of course, is, as expressed in the Tristan and Isolde story, where they both die, is that they prefer oblivion in the end to coming back to the contingent world of reality. And de Rougemont actually explained this by saying that the troubadours of Provence established this, probably through the Cathars, which was a heretical movement within Christianity, as a spiritual ephemeral love to replace the already dying myth of universal salvation at the end of the 12th century, which that was falling apart. And you had the beginning of the new kind of individualism, which gave rise to an anxiety about death. So it's not a solution. It's a dualistic in the sense that the transcendent and the contingent are separated.
Okay.
But the piece of music is so powerful because it touches both the sublime and something fatal in the center of it.
Well, let's have a listen. Welcome back to Mindfulness Music and More with me, Shalini Bala Lucas. Today we have David in the studio. David, just before we went to your first music choice, you talked about coming to mindfulness and alluded to a life crisis. Can you tell me a little bit more about what brought you to mindfulness and how it has helped you in your life?
Yes, I had from the 60s, I had an interest in, as many of us did, in Eastern philosophy and Buddhism and so on. And I had traveled a lot. I had even been to India in 1971, traveling through Africa first overland and so on, which was a real eye-opener as to what was going on in the world. I had an interest in these because many of us in the 60s felt that the what we call the military-industrial complex was kind of a consumer-driven technocracy that was spiritually empty, and we were looking for alternatives. We had kind of abandoned the orthodox religious upbringing, which was just about belief and so on, and it wasn't concerned with introspection of any kind whatsoever. So we went through a kind of existential crisis, many of us, I suppose. So there was this movement looking to the East to find. And what were these spiritualities about? They involve meditation, they involve things like that. So I was already on that track and trying to figure all of this out. Inevitably, part of this existential crisis was when your relationships went on the rocks and collapsed or fell apart for all kinds of reasons. And at that particular moment, I was started working as a photographer in India and so on, and I was offered this opportunity to go and stay on this island so I could sit and think about things or introspect a bit, and I started to learn a little bit about the Buddhist meditation tradition. So that's how it started.
And how has it helped you in your life since then?
Well, a lot. I mean, I think the meditation practice itself is very helpful, to be able to sit and be with whatever's arising, to deal with anxiety, to deal with fear, to deal with all kinds of things that crop up in our world and in one's interactions with life and one's uncertainties and one's fears about one's worth and so on in life. It's quite complex in a culture that's very competitive.
So you find it very powerful to the people, to your own life, but also to the people you teach?
Yes, I think the MBSR is a well-structured program.
So just explain the MBSR to people who may be coming to mindfulness completely fresh.
MBSR stands for Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, and it was created by Jon Kabat-Zinn in 1979 at the Massachusetts Medical School. He had been having sessions of insight meditation, Buddhist insight meditation, and he had this idea that he could compress some of this into an 8-week program that would help patients in the hospital with pre-operative stress, post-operative pain, and so on. So it was really initiated in a hospital setting to deal with stress and pain, which is interesting. And from there, since it was quite successful in dealing with that, it expanded beyond that into every other area of life and then became very popular.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I think Jon Kabat-Zinn has done a great service to the Western world. And yes, I've studied under him, so it was very, very powerful, I think, the way he taught mindfulness. Tell me how you have brought mindfulness to Kenya. I know you said you were doing it in 2015, but what do you do now to teach people? Do you do weekly sessions? Do you do retreats? What kind of things do you offer?
Well, initially I was offering just single sessions initially, but then I evolved to creating using the 8-week program, basically. The problem was getting people to sign up to 8 consecutive weeks.
People find that really hard in Kenya for some reason, 8 weeks.
Yeah, so I was compressing it into 4 weeks. I actually went to some of the private universities, and I did have the two leading student counselors from USIU on a course, and they found it really helpful. And they responded well to it. Now at Kanga Yoga Studio, I was offering the 8-week course, but I'm also offering a 10-week course, which has a lot more, I'd say, of the other aspects of the Dharma teaching.
Okay.
Bringing those back in.
Okay, we'll talk about Dharma in the next session, because we'll talk about it around your book as well. But I know you're doing a retreat in May, is that correct?
Yes, this place came to my attention last year, by chance actually, but that's a bit of a long story. And it's up in the Aberdares at 9,500 feet. It probably makes it the highest lodge in Kenya. It's in old growth forest, which is fantastic. It's very a magical place. And it's just 6 log cabins. But when I saw it, and I was invited up to visit it, when I told the man who owns it and who built it what I was doing, he was very keen to do that kind of thing. And he had used the word retreat to describe the place as its name, not lodge, for that reason. And so we've had one retreat in February, which went very well, and I've offered another one at the end of May, on 27th, 29th of May. It's a short one, unfortunately. To get people to come for a whole week is very difficult here because they're too busy.
I know, and it's actually the busy people who do need these kind of retreats.
Well, exactly, and I hope we can evolve to that at some point.
What is it, a silent retreat?
It's being presented as such, but I always am sensitive to whoever ends up coming on the retreat, if they're comfortable with that or not. Some people want it to be completely silent, others are not so sure. So the last one we did, on the second day, we had a joint discussion about it, and we said, okay, well, we'll have one silent meal and followed by a meal with conversation. Because
yes,
they felt it a bit restrictive. So it's very flexible. There's nothing set in stone.
Well, it sounds amazing. I wish I could come. As you know, I did inquire, but
I know. I wish you were coming.
I know. I really. I might have to come on my own. Leave my partner behind.
So. Well, I think you should.
when he listens to this, he won't be best pleased to hear that. and it's on the 27th of May. Is that correct?
Yes, we'd have to leave early on the Friday morning. That's
sure.
The thing. But we're providing transport too to minimise also the impact of cars driving everywhere.
It sounds fascinating, and the log cabins look beautiful.
It is, they're very cozy, they're very good wood burning stoves. It'll be quite cold at night at the end of May.
Yes, no, but I think it'll be great. So we'll find out about contact details on how to get on this retreat with you in the next session. But let's go to your second song choice. What is it and why have you chosen it?
Well, Universal Soldier was written by Donovan. It was actually written by Buffy Saint-Marie, and he sang the song and made it popular, because it wasn't popular till then. It was an anti-war song of 1965, principally against the Vietnam War. And I was thinking the other day, we don't hear a lot of anti-war songs these days, but they were very popular then. There was a huge movement against the war, along with the civil rights movement and other activities in the 60s. So it harks back to that era where we were protesting against these things. And I was just thinking the other day about the war that's now erupted in Ukraine, which is right on the perimeter of Europe, and it's the biggest conflict since the Second World War, that it was appropriate to have an anti-war song at this point. And in Donovan's Universal Soldier, he kind of points the finger at the soldier, which is interesting, whereas Bob Dylan's Masters of War points the finger at the masters of war, the governments, and so on. And so I think you have to look at both sides of that. But yes, it's a song that is timeless in that respect, I think.
It's a fascinating song. Let's have a listen.
He's 5 foot two and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you.
And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Laval? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
Welcome back to Mindfulness Music and More with me, Shalini Bala Lucas. David, you talked about finding some notes in your son's attic that you had written whilst in Sri Lanka. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And was that the basis of your book that you've just recently published?
Well, yes, because the diaries were originally intended perhaps to be something more. And then as time moved on and I became active as a photographer again, there wasn't time. And when I rediscovered them, I realized there was an opportunity to revisit this and to look at my journey as a whole and then try to really go back to my childhood and trace this path through the diaries, kind of retrospectively, which was kind of an interesting process.
It must have been fascinating to read back on how what was the time gap between writing and then rediscovering them?
30 more plus 40, almost 40 years. I mean, when I started writing, it took me a long time to write because I had to do a lot of research to build in the whole concept around the book.
When did you publish it?
Oh, recently, about a year ago.
Okay, so, and it's called The Island, A Mirror for the Soul, Journeys Towards the Heart of Dharma. What is Dharma? Can you explain that?
Dharma is basically just the collection of teachings the Buddha gave. And as you know, we've just discussed MBSR. MBSR was focused on the practice that comes from those teachings. But it came under a lot of criticism when the mindfulness program tended to get co-opted into the commercial world and commercialized and commodified and even came into the corporate world where people would in Wall Street would sit around meditating and then when they'd finished meditating they'd carry on destroying the planet,
you know? Going and making their millions.
So I think since then there's been a second and even maybe third generation of mindfulness teachers who might have started there, but they're bringing in much more of the teachings of various kinds from different lineages, which I think helps to fill it out, especially around things like ethics.
Yes.
And that kind of topic.
How do you negotiate teaching mindfulness in a secular way? Because especially in Kenya, it's a predominantly Christian country. So saying to somebody, look, mindfulness is, if you were to say I'm teaching it with Buddha's teaching, that may put people off. So how do you find that balance between teaching mindfulness in a secular way but also maybe bringing some of these teachings in?
Well, I have done this. I mean Kenya is predominantly Christian as we all know, and with the, for instance, the student counselors from USIU, I did explain that there are parallels even with Christian contemplative tradition, and I would bring Thomas Merton in to some of my sessions, for instance. So I always make this clear from the start that this is not something invented by John Kabat-Zinn, you know, 40 years ago.
Absolutely. He just brought it and repackaged it in a way.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm just trying to open it up and expand it. But I think that the word secular is very problematic. I think we're already moving into a post-secular age. And I think another interesting aspect of this that I start to bring in is we're in a post-materialism age. That's to say, we're looking now at the philosophy of metaphysical materialism, which is the default narrative behind the modern world, which has been deconstructed and is really no longer credible on the table because it's basically incoherent. If you look at quantum entanglement and non-location in quantum physics, it doesn't really match up with the relativity theory, and there's huge debates going on about what this implies. Another aspect of this is that the materialist position says that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the complexity of our material construct, and that also seems to be incoherent, whereas I think consciousness is actually fundamental.
But I think I understand what you're saying, but I feel like we're not, it's almost like we're not ready for these conversations in Kenya, or do you think I'm wrong on that?
Well, I don't know, because amongst a small group of people, I think there's certainly...
But that's a small group. What about the larger community?
That is, but it began with small groups elsewhere, and the conversation has now expanded across all walks of life. And I don't see why that conversation couldn't be initiated here in some way.
And as you say, it already has been. But how do we then make it accessible to people who are just coming into this way of thinking? It's quite daunting.
Well, it is, and that's another aspect of materialism. So I was on a webinar recently where the psychotherapist, a very interesting woman, made a presentation where she argued that materialism and fear are connected.
Yes, and just explain that, because I find that fascinating.
Well, her argument was very complex, but basically, materialism is also... Another paper was written by Bernardo Castro, which said materialism was an ego defense mechanism against feeling pain and remorse. It also, the people who adhere to it, it gives them a consolation of closure because it's a closed system. The material reality is seen to be a closed system.
Explain that.
Well, it's self-sufficient to itself. Which doesn't really make sense. Materialism offers a kind of closure, an explanation of everything. Well, there's a number of problems with this. First of all, it says everything is based on measure, right? So what the world that you see is made up of things called spin, charge, mass, velocity, which are all measurements in physics.
Yes.
None of these accounts for any qualitative experience, which is the fundamental, your fundamental experience that gives you meaning in life.
Yes.
It can't be accounted for by any of that. So they say that all that qualitative experience is simply generated by your brain and is quite secondary. And once they've completed this immense structure of numerical calculations, which is basically just a map.
Yeah.
They say they will pull the territory out of the map, which is completely absurd because you're already in the territory.
It sounds really complex.
Well, the only thing you know is on the screen of your perception.
Yes.
What you taste, see, touch, feel,
through
and so
senses,
on.
To your senses, yes.
This is your primary experience of the world. Isn't that a good place to start?
It is, but there is so much more to it than that.
Of course. This business of integration is extremely important. And mindfulness doesn't always address that. Mindfulness may give you certain peace. Mindfulness will give you the ability to have some distance from really unpleasant feelings. But if you've had severe trauma, you're going to need psychotherapy.
Absolutely. So mindfulness is just a part of... that
yes.
experience.
You do the psychotherapy.
Yes.
And then the psychotherapist may well say, well, I think you're ready to do mindfulness.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's very important to bear that in mind. And I make that very clear at the outset of teaching any course, because therapy entails the integration that comes from the connection between the limbic brain and the prefrontal cortex.
Yes.
And prefrontal cortex is the place of regulation, of it's the observer when you're meditating, or the witness consciousness. It's very open. It must allow everything in the limbic brain to be, to appear, to be expressed, and to be allowed, and to be felt. And unless you go through that process, there is no integration, because you remain in the realm of reactivity in the limbic brain.
I feel like we need another whole show to talk about all these concepts, because there's so much to
it's enormous.
It's huge.
Probably several shows.
But let's just take a break here and go to your next song choice. What is it and why have you chosen it?
Oh, well, this harks back to the 60s as well again. It's a very powerful piece of music, I find, and it was in fact used in two significant films in the 60s. One was called If, made by Lindsay Anderson, and it revolved around a story of several dissidents who were in a public boarding school in England, which was the kind of school I went to, where they rebelled against the entire establishment. And the principal part of the soundtrack was this Missa Luba, the Sanctus from Missa Luba, which was very powerful because they kept playing it in their rooms, and it was egging them on into this kind of revolution where they were going to overthrow the establishment. And of course, Lindsay Anderson actually filmed it at the actual school that he went to, and I just wish I'd been him. The other film that it came into was Pasolini's film of Christ, which was, I think, one of the best because it was black and white. It had an unknown Spanish actor who was brilliant, and it was straight from the Gospel of St. Matthew with that was the whole dialogue was coming straight from that, and it was done like a documentary, and he used part of this. So that was the sound that made me want to go to Africa.
Wow.
And I did 2 years later, driving right across from north all the way down to Cape Town and then eventually over to India, paying passengers.
Well,
and we went through the Congo and were received with enormous hospitality in remote villages, which I couldn't find on any map now. And that deep beat that comes in this song is very much, you know, the African beat from the earth.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. Welcome back to Mindfulness Music and More with me, Shalini Bala-Lucas, and I'm in conversation with David Beattie. David, the quote you chose for today is, "To be hopeful means to be uncertain about the future, to be tender towards possibility, to be dedicated to change all the way down to the bottom of your heart." And it's by Rebecca Solnit. Why have you chosen this quote?
Well, I love Rebecca Solnit. The first book I found of her some years back was called The Art of Getting Lost, which I thought was brilliant. And it's very apt right now, I think, in our times with these multiple crises in the world, which just keep escalating. And I think, if anything, one of the things that the energies that we most need is compassion, seeing the enormity of the destruction of this earth and of animals and of the immiseration of people, marginalized people, and social injustices and conflicts. And having mentioned the war earlier, let's not forget the wars in Yemen, the ones in Ethiopia and Libya, and so on. And we're standing in a very strange place, I feel, and often hope is presented as an expectation of something which, if it doesn't materialize, leads to despair. So it's kind of fear-based. There's another kind of active hope that Joanna Macy talks about, and also another of my favorite teachers is Roshi Joan Halifax, who is wonderful on this, which is a hope that stands in this place of uncertainty, but is full of the possibility that comes out of that open space. And that is a space of creative possibility to have the ability to stand in that uncertainty with no fear at all. Okay. And that is, I think, a very important place that we need to be in, to actually have conversations and collaborate with each other and cooperate with each other to turn this world away from these destructive forces that we are so enveloped in at the moment.
So very true. That's so true. You've inspired me. Every week we do a meditation, and today I'm going to do a compassion meditation. For some people, they know it as the metta meditation or loving kindness. We're just going to do a very short one. So if you're happy to join in, David.
Absolutely.
Closing your eyes or lowering your gaze, if you feel comfortable to do so. Just sitting with that for a moment as you roll your shoulders back, bringing your attention to your breath, breathing in and breathing out through your nose. And you can put your right hand in the center of your chest and the left hand on top of that. This is your heart chakra. Feel your heartbeat. Feel the warmth under your palms. Today we're going to send compassion, loving kindness to every creature, every being on this planet. So to yourself, quietly, you can say the words, "May all beings be happy.
May all beings be happy.
May all beings be filled with loving kindness.
May all beings be filled with loving kindness.
May all beings feel supported and safe.
May all beings feel supported and safe.
May all beings have love and compassion.
May all beings have love and compassion.
May all beings be happy.
May all beings be happy."
So feel the love, compassion, and gratitude that you're sending out. You may find this difficult, but try and evoke those sentiments. Repeat the words as many times as you wish in your own time. But for now, gently bringing your awareness to the space you're in, your body, my voice, and when you feel ready, opening your eyes. Thank you, David. As you can see, that was a very, very short, quick one for radio. Thank you so much for being on our show. It's been fascinating talking to you. But before you go, I just want to ask you, if I were to cast you away to a desert island and you could only take one book with you, what would it be?
Well, I thought long and hard about this because there were so many possibilities. Should I take the whole of the Dhammapada? Because I might need the Buddha's help if I was stuck there for a long time. But I thought of Ulysses, this remarkable modernist book, which is long enough, I thought, to keep me occupied. And because I tried reading it several times, I don't think I actually ever finished it. It's a long, long time since I read it. Many, many, many decades even. And I thought, well, this would be a good opportunity maybe to get to the end and to enjoy the journey with it, because it is a remarkable book.
Well, there you go. You can have it. It's definitely a good choice. And if there was one song you could play, what would it be?
The song I chose is Kol Nidrai, a piece by the cellist Jacqueline Dupre. Okay. And
why have you chosen it?
This I find a very haunting and beautiful piece of music. It always moves me. Kol Nidrai means all the vows. It's used during Yom Kippur. I think it's the Day of Atonement. It's really a prayer of atonement in a sense. Jacqueline Dupre's version is extraordinary, and I think it outdoes most others. It's really very haunting, and I think it brings to mind compassion, atonement, forgiveness, those kind of sentiments, and I think it encapsulates them beautifully.
Fantastic. Well, we will have a listen to it at the end of the show. And finally, if there was one luxury item you could take with you, what would it be?
A ball of string.
Why?
Which most people wouldn't consider luxurious, but I thought it would probably be incredibly useful. There's so many things you could probably do with it if you were stuck alone on a desert island. You might even be able to make a hammock. But I could probably even create a kite from maybe a piece of my shirt and fly a kite, because I've always wanted to fly kites, and I haven't done so since I was a small child. But of course, that might attract attention and I might get rescued, but that wasn't the main reason. Well, that might be cheating. You might think that would
no,
be cheating.
No, I think it was very inventive, actually. So I'd definitely give you the ball of string.
And there's nobody else on the island to tell me to go fly a kite, which would be another reason.
You've obviously really thought about this. Thank you, David. I'd like to present you with my book, Happiness, Is It Simply a Mindset Shift? As a thank you for appearing on the show. To all my listeners, this book is now available at Textbook Center and Rafu Books in Kenya and Amazon worldwide. Please also follow me for more mental health tips, mindfulness meditations, and lots more on my social media at Just Joom. David, thank you so much for being here and sharing so much wisdom with us. How can people reach you for your retreats and your mindfulness sessions, and of course, to buy your book as well?
Yes, they can go to my website, www.deeppractice.com, note only one P in the middle. And they can also, for retreats and courses and things, go to Kanga Studio, / Nairobi, which also has its website with timetables and upcoming events.
Fantastic. So please, listeners, do reach out to David. Thank you so much, David. To all my listeners, if you or someone you know is struggling with any mental health issues, please do seek professional help, whether that be a counselor or your doctor. You can also open up and share your feelings and mental health issues anonymously without fear of judgment on Bonga, www.bonga.or.ke. This is a safe space where you can start the healing process. We'll have David's final song choice play us out. I'm Shalini Bala Lucas. I'm grateful to all of you for your time today. Thank you for listening. And until next week, stay happy, be mindful.